WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's Election Day, and in a moment, we're going to take a closer look at a topic that was rarely spoken about during the presidential campaign, climate change. It is a political hot potato in part because of its complexity, and we're going to meet two people who have the difficult task of explaining the complexity of climate change to those who influence public policy. First, as voters make their way to the polls, we wondered what motivated them to vote or not to vote, and what information is being gathered about you as you exercise your franchise to vote. WFAE's Michael Tomczyk is where we begin. He's been talking to people all over the city about their attitudes on voting, and he joins us now. So you've been taking a microphone all over to, what, to different polling places and to grocery stores and places
like
that?
Yeah, actually, not even polling places. We wanted to try to kind of catch people in their more natural environments since, you know, polling places obviously aren't a normal place for people to congregate besides election time. So, yeah, I went to a number of different kind of shopping centers, grocery stores, just different areas where people were congregating kind of all over Charlotte. Mm-hmm. You'll hear it in, when we play this. I mean, West Charlotte, East Charlotte, North, South, I mean, all over the place. With really just the simple question, what is motivating you to vote? In this election, you know, there's been such a huge buildup to this, and we just kind of wanted to hear, well, what is it? So, you'll, as I noted with the shopping centers, you'll hear a lot of shopping carts kind of rattling around in the background. But here's what the people that we talked to had to say.
All right,
my name is Alma Miller, and I live in Northwest Charlotte. Well, I think it's our duty to vote. If you don't vote, you can't complain about anything, and even when you complain, it really sometimes doesn't appear to matter. But more than anything, I would like to have my voice heard.
Darren Bryant, live uptown. What's motivating me to vote? It's economy, definitely economy. Knowing it's going to take some time to get to where we need to be, regardless of who's in office, it's going to take some time.
Artina McDonald, east side of Charlotte. I'm fearful that times are going to change for the worse if the right person is not in office. I do have a child that I'm concerned about her future, so that means a lot to me right now.
Connie Starnes, west side. I want to make sure the person that I want in there gets in there.
Kaki Mustafa on East Charlotte. My motivation to not vote is I don't believe in choosing the lesser of two evils, and I don't believe in either candidate.
My name is Anwesha Kandaria, and I live in the Weddington area. I like Obama. I think he has done a wonderful job, and I think we need to give him 4 more years to see real progress in the economy. So I'm going to go all out for him.
My name is Benji Guy, and I live in Davidson. I think we need to change. I think our government's going in the wrong direction, and I'd badly like to see it change.
Hi, my name is Marilyn McGrath, and I live in West Charlotte. Mainly, like, watching the news and stuff like that, like, seeing what's going on in the world, and I want to have a say-so also.
Susan Young, South Charlotte, the governor's race. Charlotte Mayor Pat McCoy, and I think he'll do a great job for the state.
My name is Clarence Lee Audrey, and I'm from North Central. Number one thing is, I do believe that the president did not get his fair chance to prove himself in his first period of being the president. He got in this thing with a whole bunch of trouble from the start. I say give him a second chance.
Keith Lyon. I live in the west side of Charlotte, right by the airport. The economy. I'm like this. The mess that this country is in didn't take 4 years to build, so no matter who's president, it's going to take whoever that becomes president, it's going to take him more than 4 years to fix it, if he can.
Christy Miller, Huntersville, the economy, and the fact that I know people who may have a job still, but like I'm a teacher and I'm being paid like a fourth year teacher and I'm an eighth year teacher. My stepdad has the same job but is making 25% less. And I think that that would be the biggest motivation for me.
My name is Melvin Stafford. I live in East Charlotte. The economy and health issues. People need health care because a lot of us are working, but we don't have health care. We don't have no type of benefits or insurance or anything, and we need something, somebody that's going to give us that to help us out a little bit.
Bethany Martin in East Charlotte. I mean, it's a right. You know, we have a privilege in this country that a lot of countries don't have, so I just always have felt the importance of needing to go and vote.
So did a theme emerge as you went around town talking to potential voters?
I would say the economy was the biggest one. What was interesting is that people used the economy both to argue for change and for giving the president another shot, you know, the idea of it's not changing quickly enough or give him more time. But the other thing that was actually kind of refreshing, Mike, was just hearing so many people say civic duty. I mean, we heard a little bit of that in there, but I had a lot of people kind of come to this idea of, you know, if you don't vote, you can't complain. And this is just, you know, we're blessed to live in a place where we get to elect our representatives, and it's important.
And we await the outcome of their decision. Thank you, Michael Thompson.
You're welcome.
What you were engaging in there is not unlike what some of the political campaigns do to uncover voter intentions and motivations. We use the Australian ballot in the United States, meaning that what you do in the booth is private. Well, it may be private there, but the people you're voting for know a lot about you. In advance of Election Day, their campaigns have data mined you to a fare thee well and uncovered reams of data about you. And here to talk about that is Charles Duhigg, a reporter for the New York Times, who wrote a recent and revealing story about what I think is a little-known practice. Mr. Duhigg, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. In your article in the Times, you say that strategists affiliated with Obama and Romney's campaigns say they have access to information about the personal lives of voters on a scale never before imagined. How long has this been going on?
Well, this has really been something that's developed in the last 4 to 8 years. I wrote a book named The Power of Habit that came out earlier this year that looks at how individuals and companies try to understand the science of habit formation and how that influences decisions. You know, one of the things that we focused in on that book, and we actually ran this excerpt in the New York Times Magazine, was about how Target, for instance, studies the habits of shoppers and can learn so much about their lives and about their patterns that they can detect, for instance, when a female shopper is pregnant, even if she hasn't notified the store that she's expecting a child. Those same tactics are used by almost every single large company, and they've now moved fairly solidly into elections and into campaigns, where campaigns want to learn as much as they can about voters and then figure out how to trigger their voting habits.
But if you go to Target or you go to your favorite grocery store and you use your little card for discounts, they know you're buying certain products, and so they know your shopping habits, and I guess that's how Target knows you might be pregnant if you buy a pregnancy test or diapers or something like that.
It's actually much more subtle than that.
Okay.
Well, it's actually much more subtle than that. Obviously, buying a pregnancy test is one thing, but what Target can do is, for instance, if the vitamins you buy changes, they can use that as a clue that you're pregnant.
So
if you're buying suddenly a much larger number of washcloths, the way that campaigns use the same information is they're looking for signals that would indicate that how someone can be triggered to go to the polls. For instance, one of the things that we know is that people who support Obama, on average, are more likely to, for instance, shop at Burlington Coat Factory, or to people who support Romney are more likely to drink a Samuel Adams beer. And so by sort of understanding the habits of particular types of voters, they can then reach out to those voters and try and persuade them to get to the polls. There's two elections going on today. There's an election that has to do with everyone who is certainly going to vote. They vote all the time. Voting is a strong habit. The campaigns want to persuade them to vote for their person. But the other election, which in some respects, particularly if it's a close race, is actually a bigger deal, is convincing people just to show up and vote, right? There's millions of Obama supporters, millions of Romney supporters who it's up in the air whether they're going to stop on their way home from work to vote or whether they're just going to go home and have dinner. And so understanding how to trigger that voting habit in those low propensity voters, that's a huge part of a campaign winning. And that's what they're trying to. That's why they're learning so much about how people behave.
So how do they learn this information? Because in addition to knowing that Obama supporters shop at Burlington Coat Factory and that Romney supporters have a propensity for drinking Sam Adams beer, you say that the people who have been calling us incessantly from these campaigns this year have been reading from scripts that have access to information like whether we have visited pornography websites, the kind of beer we drink, whether we have gay friends or have a home in foreclosure. How is this information available to them?
Well, and let me make clear, the volunteer who's on the other end of the phone, that volunteer doesn't know anything about you besides what the script says. It's that the script is written by people or computers that have access to that information. And they know it because all of that is publicly available. If you're in foreclosure, that's a court record, right? Mm-hmm. So there's firms out there that sell lists of everyone who's in foreclosure in the United States. If If you're going to certain websites, when you visit BarackObama.com or MittRomney.com, they put what's called a cookie, a small piece of software, on your computer that tracks what other websites you go to and sends that information back to the campaigns. I can essentially buy information on you that tells me how you behave, and the campaigns have spent millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars across the nation, if you look at all the campaigns, buying this data, vacuuming up all that they can. And then, in addition, they use a whole bunch of information that they collect from you. When someone called you 3 months ago and they asked what you care about, whether you care about the economy or the military, they're keeping track of all of those answers and trying to make sense of who you are.
Is this the first election season where this kind of information has been so readily available, or is this the second or third generation of this kind of data mining?
Well, what's different today is that, you know, data mining was used 4 years ago in a sort of unadvanced way, because and two things have changed in the meantime. First of all, the sources of data have become much more robust, right? You can now go online and you can buy, or to companies, and you can buy almost any data set relatively easily, and there's so much more data that's been collected. But second of all, computing capacity has increased so much in the last 4 years. It used to be you had to buy a whole bunch of computers to make sense of all this data. Today, you can basically put all the data into the cloud through Amazon or another company and run your all of your programs online to make sense of all the information you have. So this is the first time that data mining has really become an incredibly important part of the strategy of how campaigns reach out to voters.
You say that much of this is aimed at reaching what you call low propensity voters, particularly in election years where the race is close, as it is this time around. So they try to motivate people who are likely not to vote to vote? Is that what they're trying to get to do, to just get you out there to the polls?
Right. As I mentioned before, there's sort of these two races going on, right? The first of which is there's people who are going to show up. They vote every 4 years. So the goal there is just to convince them to vote for their guy. But there's millions and millions of other people who they might decide to vote or they might decide not to vote, right? It's kind of a hassle to show up and vote. It takes a long time to stand in the line. And so a big part of what's going on is the Obama campaign knows that there's millions of people who, if they show up to the polls, they will vote for Barack Obama, but they might not show up to the polls. So the game is to try and figure out, how can I trigger their voting habit? How can I ensure that they show up today and that they're willing to stand online for 20 minutes and then cast their ballot? Mitt Romney's doing the exact same thing.
Does this filter down to the lower campaigns, or is this pretty much so expensive that only the presidential campaigns can involve themselves in this?
Well, pretty much every statewide campaign does this, right? Every race for governor, for Senate, for the presidential campaigns, all of those big campaigns, they do this. Now, further down the ballot, you get to things like school boards, right? These smaller elections where someone might only spend $5,000 or $10,000 on the election. In those cases, they're not doing quite as intensive data analysis, but what they are doing is that they're buying the data analysis from political consultants that work for the larger campaigns. So even in a school board race, it wouldn't be unusual for the campaign manager to have, first of all, what's called the voter file, right? The file that lists the names and addresses and party registrations of everyone within that particular district. And then to buy some add-ons, maybe some things that tell the campaign what kind of income each person has, whether that person is identified as religious or non-religious, what type of church they belong to. In addition, a lot of the state parties that are sort of the coordinating organizations for smaller races, they'll buy these large data sets and then make them available to smaller candidates.
In 10 seconds or less, how should we feel about this?
I mean, I think it depends on how you feel. You know, the truth of the matter is that we are living in an age where the concept of privacy is changing.
Yeah.
It means that when a campaign reaches out to you, they're going to know a lot more about what you care about, which for some people is great, because it means someone isn't blabbing in my ear about stuff I don't even think about.
And I have to stop you there because we have to take a break. Charles Duhigg from the New York Times, thank you very much for your time this morning. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University, celebrating 1 year in Charlotte, hosting a graduate roundtable information session on November 14th for their 8 master's programs. Details at northeastern.edu/Charlotte. And Scott Jaguar, where drivers can discover the Jaguar experience behind the wheel. Information on the Jaguar experience online at scottjag.com or at Scott Jaguar at I-77 and Tivola. On the day after the 2012 election, we go over the results with a fine-tooth comb with WFAE news reporters and our two go-to political scientists, Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte and WFAE's party line political blogger, Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College. We talk about the winners and losers and what the outcome may mean for the next 4 years for the nation, the state, and the region, and we may even hear from some of the winners. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Mixing Religion and Politics, How Religious Beliefs Inform Our Political Convictions.
Join Diane for that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Climate change is an issue that we heard only teeny bits about during this last election cycle, but we may be hearing a lot more about it as a result of Hurricane Sandy. This so-called perfect storm wreaked havoc on the highly populated Northeast, resulting in tens of billions of dollars in property damage from which it will take years to recover. It was the perfect storm in part because of our changing climate, and just another in a series of once-in-a-hundred-year storms that we've been experiencing recently. Clearly, global warming is having an impact, and not just on the temperature, but on the geography of the planet, as sea levels begin to rise and gobble up valuable real estate. Because it's Election Day, we're going to stay away from the politics of the issue, but we are going to look at how this issue is being explained by scientists to policymakers. And we're joined for the rest of the hour by two people who make that happen, or help to make that happen. Dr. Michael Mann was the lead author, or a lead author, on the Observed Climate Variability and Change chapter of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Third Scientific Assessment Report in 2001. He shared the Nobel Peace Prize with the other authors in 2007 after having been selected by Scientific American as one of the 50 leading visionaries in science and technology. He's also co-founder and contributor to the award-winning website realclimate.org, and he hails from Penn State University. Welcome to the program. Welcome to Charlotte.
It's great to be with you.
And Dr. David Szymanski is also with us. He is a geologist and forensic scientist whose research focuses on how understanding complex systems can help non-scientists solve real-world problems. He's also interested in communicating science, including the science behind climate change, to policy developers, and served as a congressional fellow and science policy advisor to Senator John Tester of Montana. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks. Great to be here, Mike.
We live in a time where we face major decisions on all kinds of complex issues, including those involving science, and we seemed stymied by a lot of these decisions, these issues that we have to think about. Then you layer in the fact, with your area of expertise, that science is not understood by the masses and, in fact, is considered suspect and even wrong by people who don't understand scientific concepts. Where does that leave you and policy makers who maybe do understand what you're talking about?
Well, it is a bit frustrating because, you know, in so many aspects of our lives, we rely, you know, on a daily basis upon technology, upon science. We wouldn't have the modern conveniences of modern life in the absence of the scientific endeavor. And yet when it comes to certain fairly contentious issues, be it evolution or climate change, it's often difficult to talk about the science because some people see it more through the lens of politics, through an ideological lens, rather than as a scientific issue.
But why? As you say, we are surrounded by science. We get in the car. Our cars today are so much better than they were in 1950. We have iPhones. We have computers. We have microwave ovens. We have medicines that cure things that people died from not too long ago. All of that created by science. Why, then, are you guys the boogeyman?
Well, I'll comment, and then I'm sure David has some additional comments. I have found myself personally in the center of the climate change debate because of an iconic graph that my co-authors and I published more than a decade ago, the so-called hockey stick curve,
yes,
which shows the anomalous recent warming. And I've written a book about my experiences, the hockey stick and the climate wars, where I talk about what it's like to be a scientist, somebody who went into this field because of a love of science, because of a love of solving problems. And then when our scientific findings had implications for this larger debate about climate change and what to do about it, we suddenly found ourselves at the center of attacks by those who find the science of climate change inconvenient, because it does indeed imply that we need to shift towards a different way of doing things.
Inconvenient is an interesting word to use because of the famous documentary An Inconvenient Truth. And wasn't that about climate change as well?
It was indeed. Yeah. And in fact, by and large, it got the science right for all the criticism of the movie. It actually did a pretty good job in conveying our basic understanding of the science.
Now, Dr. Mann, you, as I said, you like to help policymakers understand science and why they should be interested in doing what they need to do to help you with climate change, for instance. Has it been your experience that most of the politicians that you talk to, most of the policymakers that you talk to, view science through a political lens, or is something else at work here?
Yeah, it's true, and I wouldn't necessarily call it a political lens. I would just say that there's always a number of competing interests when you're making science policy. So as scientists, we try to put the best science we can into the policy, but then there's a number of other factors that play into it. Economics, for example. I mean, you look at the data on public belief, and I put belief in quotes, on climate change over the last 10 years, and you'll see it's a roller coaster, and most of those factors have to do with the economy. When it comes to actually where the rubber meets the road and actually make policy, people put a lot of things ahead of climate change before they actually make any sort of decision about any sort of policy on climate.
I gave you the wrong name. You're actually Dr. Szymanski, but you answered the question anyway. And that's you're the one I wanted to address the question to, so I apologize. You say that the conversation about this needs to be among policymakers and scientists and the media.
That's right.
How are we doing?
In general, good. I don't want to indict all of media, but there is certainly a way that these things play together that can actually detract from the real debate. The fact that, for example, survey after survey shows that scientists rank among the most respected, the most prestigious professions, above sometimes nurses and right below firefighters. So the public has a great confidence in scientists in general. However, when we look at, for example, a question that the Pew Trust comes up with and they ask, you know, do you believe scientists in general agree that human activities are causing the Earth's climate to change, to grow in temperature? And only 40% say yes. So there's a disconnect, a belief in the scientists, but a belief that there's some sort of widespread controversy, a difference between, and that just does not exist. 99% of climate researchers who do active research agree that the Earth's temperature is affected by human activity.
I was just going to follow up. Some of the recent numbers actually suggest a substantial increase now in the recognition among the public of the reality of global warming, and to some extent that's been attributed to the record-breaking weather we have seen over the past several months, record-breaking drought, heat, wildfires, Arctic sea ice reaching the lowest levels that we've ever seen. And now, of course, on the heels of Hurricane Sandy, several attributes of which probably were associated, influenced by climate change, the public's starting to get it.
Right. And we're always loathe, and I think the last 5 years has shown this, as climate communicators, we're always loathe to link any particular event to climate change because mm-hmm. we don't want to face the feedback that we get then when we have an especially snowy or especially cold winter. Where's your climate change now?
Right.
But at the same time, we're probably posing the question incorrectly. All of these events, Sandy, the record drought, the sea ice, loss of 40% sea ice, summer sea ice now in the Arctic, amazing events. The question should be is how much is climate change contributing to each of those individual events?
You know, we've heard some whoppers being told in this presidential campaign on both sides. And we seem to have a group of people in the country, and it seems to be a large group of people in the country, who simply say, don't confuse me with the facts. What I believe is the truth. And it gets back to that question that we hear, or the statement that we hear from pundits and certain politicians, that there is no consensus among scientists about the veracity of climate change. You say there is.
Yes, and so, and as you allude to, we've sort of, unfortunately, in our public discourse, we've reached this place where, riffing off of the words, the famous words of Daniel P. Moynihan, people now feel entitled to their own facts, not just their own opinions, but their own facts. And that's very dangerous when you're talking about matters of science that have policy implications. So, you know, what does the U.S. National Academy of Sciences have to say about this? Founded by a Republican president, by the way, Abraham Lincoln, back in the 19th century. And they're firmly on record as stating that climate change is real, the planet is warming, the climate is changing, and it's because of human activity. And it isn't just our National Academy. It's the National Academies of all the major industrial nations who are in record stating the same affirmative case. And literally every scientific society, including the Geological Society of America, which is in town here for their conference, every scientific society that deals in areas of science relevant to climate change are also on record as stating that climate change is real.
So from a scientific point of view, the question is not whether or not the climate is changing. The question is, I guess there would be two questions. What, if anything, to do about it? And what is the primary cause? Because you have to understand that, I suppose, if you can attempt to do anything about it. Who needs to raise that question and how is it being communicated?
Well, that's a good point. And scientists are working on that second point you mentioned. In other words, looking at the cause. And even though there may be some more disagreement on the small numbers about what proportion of the temperature increase that we see, where it's coming from, it's still undoubtedly, and the wording gets even stronger and stronger in every report every year, that humans are causing the lion's share of that increase in temperature. And Dr. Mann just mentioned every scientific society that knows anything about this has come out with firmer and firmer, including the Geological Society of America, which just last year released an even stronger statement about humans impacting climate change. There's no disagreement on that side even. So the first point you made, the question really becomes what to do about it.
Okay.
But these are legitimate policy questions. This is where we need to be in order to start the conversation. We're not there yet.
Is this a United States policy question? It strikes me that it has to be a world policy question.
Well, it is, and it has to be. And there's going to be an opportunity in the next conference of the parties in Doha for various nations, industrial world and the developing world to come together and see if we can reach some sort of consensus about what to do about this problem.
And yet in this country, you say that we face something or that it's being called by some, something called the new McCarthyism when it comes to climate change and the politics of climate change. Is that an accurate description, you think? It's not your term. Is it accurate?
Well, it is. You know, it's been used by, you know, fairly staid, newspapers that have editorialized on this issue have called out some of our politicians for engaging in what they see as McCarthyist attacks against science.
And you've called them out. You in your book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, you talk about what you call a well-funded campaign to discredit climate change and describe efforts by opponents with ties to the fossil fuel industry to harass climate scientists and create doubt about climate change. Is this only happening in the United States, or is this happening with other countries and other governments?
Yeah, no, it's happening anywhere where there is the possibility of policies being enacted to deal with carbon emissions reductions. You see these groups go in and generate a campaign of disinformation to try to thwart progress on the policy front. You see it in Australia. You see it in Europe now. And, of course, we've seen it for more than a decade here in the U.S.
Are they being successful in shutting down the conversation?
Well, I think what they've done is they've delayed action. Ultimately, you know, people are figuring this out for themselves. And, you know, we did in the case of acid rain, just as we did in the case of tobacco, eventually we will collectively recognize that this problem has become too big, that we need to do something about it. The danger is that we go too far down this road to the point where we commit to dangerous changes in our climate that we can no longer undo.
And Mike, just to speak to that same point, is it working? These well-funded campaigns, there's a reason why only 42% of Americans believe that climate scientists, who they trust, think there's any sort of agreement on climate science. I mean, that doesn't just come out of the blue.
Let me ask you, do you think that the people who are spewing this information believe it, or is it simply money at the root of this. The stakes are pretty high here, it seems to me. Do they believe what they're saying?
I talk to this in my book. You know, I think they're, you know, the reasons for denying climate change are as diverse as the reasons people hold any views. And there are people who, you know, are genuinely believe that the science is wrong. They genuinely distrust scientists. There are people who sort of like to play the devil's advocate. They like to take a contrarian stance. There are many different reasons, but what the commonality is the fact that there is this infrastructure, that there is this disinformation effort that amplifies whatever doubt or cynicism exists in the first place.
Well, they might allege that scientists have an agenda. Are there instances in the past that you can think of where scientists have cried wolf and gotten away with it or taken us down a path that we didn't have to go down?
You know, in my view, I think we've seen far more examples of the opposite, whether it's acid rain or ozone depletion. We saw an effort at the time, often again funded by industry groups, front groups looking to sort of pollute the public discussion. We've seen efforts to discredit the science, whether it's acid rain, whether it's ozone depletion, whether it's tobacco and its linkage with lung cancer. In every case, of course, the science, we can look back and say the science got it right, but we acted too late. We lost too many lives. We destroyed the environment. We went farther down that road than we needed to because of the effectiveness of the disinformation campaigns whose sole intent is to cloud the issue, to introduce false uncertainty, to manufacture debate, rather than have that good faith debate that there is to be had about what to do about these problems.
That's right. And more importantly is that the media complicity, and I don't mean to sound conspiracy theorist on this, but in an attempt to present a balanced argument, when we see things like a campaign to discredit some of the science and climate science, even though there's no basis for it, what ends up happening is we get this idea that in order to present a balanced view of climate change, you have to have a climate change scientist and a climate skeptic.
Yeah.
Those are not equal things.
We are hearing more and more in the media criticism about this on this and many other issues that we feel this compulsion to appear fair and balanced, not to use the Fox term, but to be fair, and have two sides of the same issue given equal time. And you're saying we shouldn't be giving equal time because the other side isn't science.
That's right.
Just, how are we supposed to make that decision and appear fair?
Well, just imagine, you know, if every time NASA made a new discovery, a new exoplanet or some exciting new development in the Mars mission, that we had two people side by side discussing the matter, a NASA scientist and the president of the Flat Earth Society, because we felt we had to have both views represented. Right. It's almost that ridiculous, and yet we're willing to do that when it comes to matters of climate change and other areas of contentious science where there are vested interests who don't want to see us have the fair debate.
I think most people would look at the Flat Earth Society and go, they're just kooks, but not everybody understands climate change. And so we can't look at the other side and say, well, they're just kooks, because we're not experts. We don't know. So as a media person, as people in the media who are trying to be fair, who are trying to get the truth out, how do we assess? How do we make that determination?
That's a great question. And I think that you've hit on the key here is that this cannot be actually formed in the kind of debate style. What this has to be is it's incumbent upon scientists to be out here, to be talking and have an engaged discussion with the public. It's earth science literacy on one hand, but it's also the responsibility of scientists to actually communicate it.
It's Dr. David Szymanski. He's here with Dr. Michael Mann. We're talking about climate change and how to communicate the urgency and the truth of it to policymakers and others. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. The symphony and oratorio singers perform Mozart's Mass in C minor under the direction of Christopher Warren Green, November 16th and 17th in the Belk Theater. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. And the Firebird Arts Alliance hosting the American Spiritual Ensemble in a blend of spirituals, Broadway, and gospel, 7 p.m. this Friday and Saturday. Details at singblacksingwhite.org. Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about how religious beliefs are informing political convictions in the 2012 election coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. And if you would like to join this segment of our conversation about climate change and informing public policymakers or informing yourself, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
From road rage to school bullying, many people think something's missing in today's society.
R-E-S-P-C-T, find out what it means to me.
Join WFAE for a public conversation on respect. We'll explore why respect seems to be in short supply, the consequences, and possible solutions. Wednesday evening, November 14th at Imaginon. The community forum is free. Details are at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The Geological Society of America's 124th annual meeting and exposition is being held in our city, which is why we have two scientists with us this morning, Dr. David Szymanski, assistant professor of geology and a forensic scientist at Bentley University, and Dr. Michael Mann, a climatologist and physicist and director of Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. And we're talking about climate change. Hurricane Sandy has done significant damage to the country and to lives, permanently changing people's lives. And it was called the perfect storm because it was a massive hurricane, perhaps the largest we've ever seen. And it met with another system coming in from the northwest, cold air meeting hot, moist, warm air. And it caused everything from incredible blizzards to intense destruction and high winds and ocean rise. And yet, some people say... This is not climate change, and this is another in a series of once-in-a-lifetime events that we've experienced over the last 5 or 6 years. Is this a teaching moment? Is this a learning moment?
It is, and I was quoted, actually, the other day in calling this a Cuyahoga River moment, maybe.
Explain that.
So back in the 1970s, when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, it was a wake-up call that we couldn't get away with, you know, polluting, with dumping toxic waste into our waterways. It was a wake-up call that we had a problem we needed to act on, and it was a single event. There's some reason to believe that maybe Sandy will provide that for climate change. It sort of inserted itself into the discussion at a particularly interesting time in the closing days of a presidential campaign. And so suddenly the issue of climate change and the relationship it may have played, and I think there are many there are a number of arguments that one can make that climate change did at least worsen the impacts of Sandy. Now that's part of our discussion.
Many people accuse you guys of being alarmist when it comes to climate change. So at the risk of being called an alarmist, what do you see as the fundamental truth about climate change that we need to know right now?
Well, you know, there's a real irony to this accusation that we often hear that we're being too alarmist, when in fact, if you look back at the history of climate science, we, climate scientists collectively, have been just the opposite. We have understated the rate of change and the magnitude of change. And one example is what's happening in the Arctic right now. If you look at the record low levels of sea ice, you know, near ice-free conditions in the Arctic Ocean at the end of this last summer, the observational trend, the rate of decline, is literally decades ahead of where the models say we should be right now. So when we're talking about the decline in Arctic sea ice, we have understated, as scientists, the rate and the magnitude of the problem. When it comes to the melting of the major ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet, once again, the measurements tell us that we are decades ahead of schedule relative to what the models predicted. So in many respects, you know, there is uncertainty in the science, but uncertainty is a two-way street. It can cut for you or it can cut against you. And in many respects, uncertainty is cutting against us, and that's why economists who study the problem say uncertainty is actually a reason to act even faster on this
problem.
But
how do we know we're causing this? How do we know this isn't just something that the Earth goes through every 100 million years?
Dr. Manns can speak to this. I mean, this has been decades and decades of research that climate researchers all over the world have been able to make this connection, make it very clear. all of the alternative hypotheses that have come up, which have been well tested. You know, we hear all the time about different cycles of warble in the Earth. We hear about sunspots. All of those can be teased out, and they have been, as a matter of fact, in the IPCC reports. And we see that the bulk of this is coming from human activity. There's just no question about it.
In fact, if you look at the natural factors that do influence climate, small changes in the brightness of the sun, which we can measure with satellites, volcanic eruptions, the models tell us the climate actually should have cooled in recent decades because of these factors. And instead, of course, it has accelerated and it's warming.
Is this all due to our burning of fossil fuels, in your opinion?
Well, the fact that the natural trend should have been one of slight cooling means that literally more than 100% of the warming we've seen is due to greenhouse gas increases. In other words, we would have seen even more warming if it weren't for natural factors that have pushed slightly in the opposite direction. But those natural factors will turn around. They're not going to impede this long-term warming trend. And so when they turn in the other direction, we'll see even faster rates of warming.
I haven't read this whole comment yet from Shane on Facebook, but I think this is illustrative of the problem that you face. Consensus does not make a fact, he says. At one time, the consensus was the Earth was flat. I believe in climate change. It has always changed and always will. What is more important is, can these scientists tell me the exact amount that man has affected climate change? The lion's share is not a fact. It's an opinion, as is consensus. We should not be spending ungodly amounts of and restricting everything because of climate change. The climate's going to change. Let's spend money on living with it because it's always going to change. Is the amount we can reduce enough to justify the costs? I think not.
And he actually makes some good points. The one I would disagree with is what we talk about, the use of consensus. And I had a grad school advisor who always told me we don't do science by consensus. So he's absolutely right in that respect. But when we're trying to portray to the public and actually communicate the risks of climate change, it's important to make sure that the public knows that there is no scientific debate about the data we have. And that's where the consensus comes in.
There's no scientific debate about whether or not the climate is changing. It is.
It is.
Is there debate on the cause?
No.
Is the consensus, is the belief among the majority of scientists or a supermajority of scientists that it's being caused by man and our burning of fossil fuels?
Yes, and let me make that more pointed. Of all the climate scientists who do peer-reviewed work, in other words, we have studies that show of all these climate scientists who are actively engaged in research and publishing peer-reviewed, in other words, it's going out to other scientists to review the methods and the conclusions, there is a 99% consensus that these two facts are true.
Yeah, I mean, there's this sense that sometimes exists out there that this is science is sort of a love fest, that we're just, reinforcing each other's views, when in fact, using the words of a colleague of mine, it's much more like a contact sport. Science can be very contentious. Scientists are inherently skeptical. When one of our fellow scientists presents results that are surprising to us, we question those results. We apply the appropriate scrutiny to them. And so scientists are constantly debating the details, the data, the interpretation. And the fact is, if you go to this conference that's taking place here in Charlotte this week, you will see scientists debating, whether or not there's a substantial increase in major hurricanes. What's the relationship between El Nino and regional climate changes? You'll see all sorts of topics being debated by scientists. But you know what you won't see debated? Whether or not the Earth is warming, whether or not the climate is changing, whether or not human activity is responsible for that. We've moved on. We are debating the details now.
But is that part of the problem? For instance, there are people who say, well, the theory of evolution is just a theory. It's not real. It's a theory. It's a semantic problem. And we see you arguing about things and debating things, and we think, well, they're arguing and debating. It's not definitive. It's not real.
There's a great example, Mike, of the disconnect between scientists and the public. And there's nowhere to lay the blame here but between scientists and the public. The way that we use theory, for example, in science is much stronger. It's something that has been tested rigorously over and over with the same results.
But we don't understand that.
And
our scientific education is declining in this country, not increasing.
We have a theory of gravity, right? We don't contest that.
Nobody debates whether or not they're going to fly out of bed in the morning when they step out. But it is the same. It's a well-tested, well-grounded, well-repeated test that we can go back to every time. When you talk about evolution, and of course this goes to the controversy of whether or not we should teach evolution side by side with creationism or intelligent design. Those two are not – intelligent design and creationism are not testable. They are not science. There's no incompatibility. It's just they don't belong being taught in a science classroom.
Why is this so threatening to people?
Well, I think ultimately the science does imply that we are changing an environment in a fundamental way, and that there is a threat, and we are potentially damaging the planet, the one planet that we have to live on, and yet people are afraid that if we change our way of life, if we stop emitting fossil fuels, that maybe there'll be some damage to the economy, and the climate change sort of contrarians often try to push this idea, and we heard it earlier, that we will damage the economy by acting on the problem, when in fact, if you look at what economists have actually concluded, the cost of inaction, and we're seeing this play out in, 11 different billion-dollar weather and climate-related disasters in the U.S. over the last year. Sandy may end up being one of the most costly weather and climate-related disasters on history. The costs of inaction are far greater than the cost of incentivizing a transition to non-carbon-based energy sources so that we do not destroy the planet. We grow the economy while preserving the environment.
I was going to ask you later in this conversation, but I'll ask you now. We know that the oil and gas lobby is powerful, and this is part of the reason why this campaign of disinformation, if there is one, has occurred. At what point does the insurance lobby get involved in all this, and are they as powerful or more powerful than the oil and gas lobby? Because they have trillions of dollars at stake in this.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, this is becoming clearer and clearer. I teach at a university where we teach predominantly business students. And there are jobs now opening up in new kinds of ways for actuaries, for other people who are looking at long-term, what do you do with coastlines that are essentially going to be disappearing? And who takes care of some of the insurance issues with that? So I would say that the insurance industry is in a more reactionary position as opposed to the fossil fuel industry, which is in a kind of proactive stage right now.
You have been personally attacked about this to a pretty disgusting degree, actually. And at least one senator I know keeps a list of climate scientists, kind of sounds McCarthyite, McCarthyist, scientist that he once investigated. He had you investigated. This is pretty intimidating, it would seem to me, for a scientist. How do you fight back?
Well, yeah, it certainly wasn't what I imagined I would, the position that I would be in when I decided to study applied math and physics as an undergraduate and go on to do a degree in physics and then on to geophysics and climate science. Never did I imagine that I would end up finding myself in the center of this raging societal debate about climate change. Unfortunately, because the implications of the science of climate change are threatening to certain vested interests who, frankly, are very happy with the status quo, very happy with our reliance on fossil fuel burning. They're making a lot of money from it.
Yeah,
they don't want to see it change.
But even these guys who are making multi-billion dollar salaries at the heads of oil companies live on the planet.
Well, that's exactly right. And they they have children and grandchildren, and I believe that they care as much as we do about the world that we leave behind for our children and grandchildren. So I have some optimism that increasingly some of the captains of industry who are in a position to sort of help move us in the direction we need to go will recognize that.
We only have a couple minutes left, but I want to bring up a fact that I don't think many people know about. I didn't know about this until yesterday. Some scientists believe that North America, where we live, will be the epicenter of increased weather activity from global warming. One report written for an insurance company says, nowhere in the world is the rising number of natural catastrophes more evident than in North America, where there has been nearly a quintupled number of weather-related loss events in the past 3 decades. Why are we the epicenter?
Well, obviously we are most sensitive to what is happening to us. And, sometimes climate change is portrayed as this, this far-off problem that involves the Arctic and melting ice and polar bears, when in fact climate change is impacting us directly in our daily lives. Food prices, the dramatic increase we've seen over the last year in food prices is directly related to climate and weather-related disasters. Crops here in the U.S. this summer were devastated by drought. I was down in Texas a few weeks ago talking about climate change, and I actually met ranchers and farmers who say that they are being devastated by the record heat and drought that they've seen in recent years. And when, ranchers and farmers in Texas are complaining about climate change, it suggests to me that maybe we're getting pretty close to that turning point where we will do something.
How close are we to the turning point where it may be too late to do anything?
Well, this is another great point in terms of communicating risk, and this is where, again, we have a session in the Geological Society of America meeting this afternoon specifically looking at this, where how do we communicate risk to a public when we have some scientific uncertainty? Mm-hmm. And we know that the definition of uncertainty as a scientist uses it is very different from uncertainty that the way that the layperson right. uses it. But it's incumbent upon us to really communicate those risks. What are they going to be? We're already starting to see them. How bad is it going to get? We don't know. The risk really comes down to we must communicate what is possible and what might not be possible.
But you're up against a big megaphone on the other side. In 20 seconds, do you have any idea how to do this?
We keep working on it. I think one of the things that's most important is to work on scientists getting out there, working on public literacy and science issues. That's the only way we can make it meet.
Dr. David Szymanski, Associate Professor of Geology and Forensic Scientist at Bentley University, and Dr. Michael Mann, Climatologist, Physicist, Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure.
It's warm in here right now.
It's getting warmer.